Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome back to another episode of the Umrepreneur podcast. You know, I work really hard to bring you amazing guests, and this episode is no different. I have with me the one and only Saad Malik, who is the CEO and co-founder of Zoya Finance, which you might have heard before because they're actually, mashallah, growing in the Muslim space, and they're doing amazing work in helping people invest in Sharia-compliant portfolios and really invest with confidence and clarity that all their investments are halal, alhamdulillah. So we're going to dive into that, dive into what they do, what's the vision behind Zoya, and also maybe even share with you a few tips on entrepreneurship and investing as well. Saad, assalamu alaikum. How are you today?
Wa alaikum salam. I'm doing well. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, very good. Thank you so much for asking, man. I'd love to get a little bit of a background actually on your story before we dive into Zoya Finance and where it's at today, because a lot of people know the company, but they probably don't know much about you and what was the purpose behind creating it in the first place and what your vision was. So can you tell me more about maybe where you were at in life when you got the idea for Zoya Finance? What is it that sparked the idea for you?
Sure. So I'm 31 years old now, but the story started back when I was around 21, 22 years old, almost a decade ago. But I was working at my first, it was a startup that I had joined right after leaving school. And at the time, we were building at that startup a investing platform, as well as various different kind of brokerage services for financial institutions. And so at my time there, I realized that, okay, you know, it's great what we're doing for the rest of the world, but it'd be great to have something like this for Muslims, particularly around investing in line with our values. And it was really relevant to me at the time because I also decided to get married at a pretty young age. So right when I was 21, 22, I said I would get married. And of course, when you're getting married, the first thing you start thinking about is like, well, I'm starting a family. I have to start focusing on my finances and have that sorted out. And so for me, that was really the start of my journey, which was like, okay, well, I do want to get my finances in order, build a nest egg for my family longer term. How do I do that in a way that doesn't compromise my faith? And I started exploring options in the market. This was right around the time when some of these really cool and exciting fintechs were popping up, at least here in the US, companies like Robinhood and Wealthfront and so on and so forth. And I just felt like, hey, you know, I wish there was something like that for us to be able to do the same thing. But unfortunately, our options were limited to really just a few ways to invest in a halal way. One was you could either invest in a mutual fund, and mutual funds are great, but they're also very restricting in the sense that it's just one fund and everyone has to invest in that fund. You can't pick and choose the companies that the fund invests in. Typically, their fees are also quite high, roughly around 1% AUM or assets under management, which can add up quite a bit over time. So that was one option. The other option was you hire a financial advisor and pay them thousands of dollars to do that work for you in terms of, you know, screening individual companies and figuring out what's halal and what's not. And the third option was for you to do it yourself, which I think the average person really does not have the time to sit there and sift through hours and hours of research when it comes to financial statements and complex documents to understand if something is Sharia compliant or not. And so that's really kind of where I started. And I ended up reaching out to a childhood best friend of mine. His name is Bilal. And Bilal and I, growing up, we grew up together. We used to always work on various different projects together, hackathons, things like that. So it wasn't uncommon for me to reach out to him and say, hey, I have this idea I'm tinkering with, you know, maybe we should tackle it together. Mm-hmm. And so that's really how it started. But it wasn't until, you know, fast forward 2017, 2018, when we started kind of more actively hacking away on our nights and weekends is when we actually ended up building something that was ready to bring to end users.
At that time, what were you doing for a living?
So I was working at that that fintech startup. That was kind of my first real job. And then I left that.
That was a 9 to 5. And were you still working there when you were building Zoya in those early days?
No, at that point, I hadn't started building anything yet. I was still trying to figure out what, you know, Islamic finance is. How does it work? What's the criteria for evaluating companies from a Sharia compliance perspective? What is Sharia compliance even? And I remember, you know, reading through all these documents and basically feeling like I was falling down this rabbit hole of like all these different scholarly opinions. And one scholar says this is okay, another says this is not okay. And then coming across all sorts of conflicting standards and just feeling more lost at the end of it than I did when I first began the journey. And so I thought, hey, you know, there has to be a better way. And turns out there wasn't a better way. And I think that was kind of the trigger for me that, okay, I need to do something about it. But I didn't think at the time that it would be a business of any kind. It was really just like, hey, it would be a cool project to kind of hack together. But beyond that, we didn't think that anyone would be willing to pay for it. It would be a real business. So after I left that fintech startup, I actually got an opportunity to join JP Morgan, which is a major financial services company here in the US. They're actually a global company. And so a lot of my career prior to working on Zoya full time was actually at JP Morgan. So learned a lot in that process. And I think it prepared me quite well to then start working on my startup more seriously.
Okay, got it, man. So at what point do you recall the day you gave in your resignation?
Oh yeah, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, it was just, I think I just crossed, or I will be crossing the 2-year mark in April, early April. And I still have the resignation email that I screenshotted. And I remember staring at it for about 8 hours before I sent it. And I was so nervous, just literally sweating all day, super nervous. And this was during the pandemic. So my manager at the time, I hadn't even met her in person yet. And so this all happened virtually and no one saw it coming. And once I sent it, I just felt like there was this huge load that was lifted off my shoulders, and it just felt amazing after that.
Amazing, mashallah. And let me ask you this, because a lot of entrepreneurs are listening to this, you know, they're either trying to get to that point or maybe they've gone to that point and they remember it. And one question that I have for you is, at the time that you gave in your resignation when you were going to work full-time on Zoya, what is it that gave you the confidence to say, you know what, I think this can really take off? Did you wait until the business was generating enough for you to have a full-time income? Was it just kind of the growth was giving you confidence that this could truly be a profitable venture? What is it that kind of, you know, just clinched it for you?
Yes. So that's it's a loaded answer because there's quite a few things that went into making that decision to finally leave and work on it full time. I always wanted to get to that point. However, I was being reasonable because I have a family to take care of. And my wife, when we got married, she was still a student. So she was still a student for the majority of the time that I was working on Zoya part-time. And so I needed to make sure that, you know, we had some sort of, you know, a cushion to fall back on in terms of like, if, you know, Zoya fell apart and, you know, I couldn't make ends meet, then, you know, at least we'd have savings, and maybe my wife, you know, also working would help in that regard. Here in the US, you know, as you know, when it comes to health insurance, that's a really big deal. And so I wanted to make sure that I also had that lined up as well through my wife's job, in case, again, something happened. And so that was certainly one of the biggest factors. However, what I think expedited it for me in terms of making that decision a little bit easier was that when we actually launched our MVP version of Zoya. So this was our private beta. It was in 2019. And we had a couple hundred people who had signed up on our landing page at the time. And so we basically put out the app for them and said, hey, would love to get your feedback as we build this thing. It was entirely free at the time. And again, we didn't know if anyone would be willing to pay for it. We weren't confident enough at the time. But we spent almost a year staying in private beta, being very close to those early users, getting their feedback. To the point where they loved the product so much, they fell in so much love with the product that they were begging us to take their money. In fact, every single week, I would get an email from a user saying, hey, this is so valuable to me. I don't want this to go away. Please allow me to support the project. And the reason that we were even getting these types of people was because the problem that we solved initially was actually not a problem. Was not a problem for a lot of people, but it was a huge problem for a small set of people, right? These are people who were managing their own portfolios for the last decade plus, doing it manually, and they knew the amount of work that went into it and how much time we saved them. And so immediately they got it, they wanted to support it, and they are the ones who gave us confidence to then launch in 2020, just about a year later, right at the beginning of the pandemic. So this was May of 2020. We said, okay, let's just go live with this thing. We still don't know if people are willing to pay for it. We'll just start charging and we'll see where things go. And something really interesting happened. So we got one very lucky with timing. So 2019 was a great bull market for stocks. So was 2020. We had the COVID crash followed by another bull market. So generally more and more people were interested in investing and entering the markets. So timing was great in that sense, but then also that initial set of users from our private beta essentially became our first true, you know, what's that term? Your first 1,000 true fans, right? So essentially they became our true fans, and they were out there talking about us for free, right? And so when we ended up going live, They Why Now started sharing it, and we started growing organically from there. So much so that I think when we went live, we had about 1,000 or 2,000 users coming out of that private beta. And after that, I think we scaled up to something like, 30, 40,000 plus users in just a matter of 3 to 4 months. In fact, we went from zero in revenue to a six-figure run rate in less than 8 months, which is unheard of, right? And this is for a company that, again, it's not like we had a full-fledged investing app. It was just a utility solving one very specific problem. And we just got lucky in the sense that, people were willing to support us, and we scaled up without spending a single dollar in marketing. So to this day, by the way, and I know we're jumping a little bit, but we haven't spent any money on marketing. All of our growth has been organic, and not just organic, but word of mouth specifically. And, so today we sit at over 150,000 users globally. Mm-hmm. And again, that's without any sort of marketing function on the team today.
Amazing, mashallah. What inspired the name Zoya? What's the background for that?
Yeah, so I mean, our parent company name, our original name was actually Investru, Invest R-O-O, one word, and which was also a bad name. But the thing is that we wanted to create, as we were thinking about kind of the long-term vision behind what we wanted to do, we started to realize that it was beyond investing. It was more than investing. And we didn't want users to think that we were just kind of focused on the investing side, because the bigger problem that we're trying to solve is helping Muslims manage their finances in a way that is, in line with their values. Mm-hmm. And so, having a name with invest in it would kind of restrict us in that sense. And so we started thinking about alternative names, and we didn't want it to be anything too Muslim sounding, because I felt like a lot of those were like very cheesy names. And so we thought, okay, well, there seems to be this trend of startups that are naming their products after like human names, right? So it was like Albert was there's another personal finance app and several more of that nature. And so we thought, hey, okay, what's a name that we could come up with that is sort of like Muslim sounding? It's a little bit feminine in nature, which makes it a little bit more approachable, because traditionally financial services are intimidating. So we wanted to make it very approachable. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, hey, Zoya is a pretty good name for that. And then also, it is also in a way kind of derives from the Arabic word of Zawiya, which kind of refers to like an Islamic institution. And so it's a word, kind of a play on words that way as well.
Interesting, man. Yeah, that's really cool. So, I mean, it's catchy. You know what? Like, it sticks. Like, after you hear it for the first time, like, you don't really forget it. So that's really interesting the way that
it's easy to remember, easy to pronounce, and then it's easy to build on as well. So, there's Zoya Invest and Zoya X, Zoya Y, whatever you want to launch in the future. It kind of flows in nicely.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So did you guys initially launch with the purpose of helping Muslims kind of invest in the stock market in a way where they have they really have an easier time finding halal ways, or even halal stocks, so that they can invest in? Or did you have something else in mind, and that ultimately then changed shape as you started building, which obviously happens with every single business?
Yeah, so the very first idea that we had was actually like, hey, I'm working at this fintech startup. We're building a brokerage platform, which allows developers to plug in and offer trading services. Why don't I become a customer of that product or that platform and essentially use their APIs to offer investing directly to Muslims? So that solved one of the problems, which was like, we want to build an investing app for Muslims. We need to be able to set up the whole trading services. We'll just plug in via API with this brokerage. They'll handle all the trading stuff. We don't have to become licensed or anything like that. But the other part of the problem was solving for, hey, where do we get access to data that actually tells us what's compliant and what's not, right? And so at that point, we started looking at a few providers who were servicing this industry for the last decade or two. These are essentially the incumbents. And they have their data providers, they have teams, armies of analysts who basically manually review this data, determine what is Sharia compliant, what isn't, and then they sell this data to other institutions. So other financial institutions, other data providers, index providers, so on and so forth. So they're primarily B2B. They didn't care about the consumer market. They were primarily focused on the B2B market. And so we reached out to them and we said, hey, this is what we're thinking about. We're thinking about building a product for retail investors. Would you be interested in partnering with us? And initially there was some hesitation. Eventually they warmed up to it. But then when the economics came up, it just really didn't make any sense for us. They didn't really fully understand what it is that we were trying to do. We were really trying to make this more accessible to more people globally. And the way that they were, proposing that they would work with us was very restricting in nature. They weren't very transparent in terms of the data that they were providing. So for example, if I tell you that Apple is Sharia compliant and you want to know why, I wouldn't be able to answer that question confidently because I didn't have that information. And our thesis was like, look, retail investors are becoming more sophisticated. They have access to so many more tools than they did before. They're going to start asking these questions. And so what do we do? And so we basically ended up wasting several months trying to negotiate with them. It didn't work out. We moved on from one incumbent to another. The second incumbent was even funnier because they said, yeah, we can help you. And then they stopped answering our emails for about a month or so. And then they come back to us and say, hey, we're actually building something internally that might be of conflict with what you're building, which, by the way, they didn't mention to us a month ago. And this is after we had already sent them all of our wireframes and all like the insider documents to show them exactly what we were building. So we're not trying to jump to conclusions there, but we have our doubts. And and so we felt like we were cornered, and we felt very disappointed, and felt like, okay, well, we could either give up at this point or we can figure out a way to do this ourselves. And I think that's what started kind of like, that was a pivotal moment for us, because we needed to determine, okay, well, in order to actually do this the way that we want to, we need to find a way to be able to screen stocks ourselves at scale and in a way that is accurate, if not better than what the incumbents are able to provide. And so at this time, it was just my partner and I was still working on this kind of part-time in our nights and weekends. And, 3 months later, we had a prototype and it was working really well. And we were able to do it through automation and some kind of clever algorithmic sort of strategies rather than relying on human capital to screen these things manually. And we tested it and we looked at the data and we said, hey, this looks a lot better than what these incumbents have been providing and selling for tens of thousands of dollars to other enterprises. And at that point we said, okay, well, we just need to open this up to more people and essentially crowdsource error correction and see, what is there that we're not able to catch. And that's what led us to doing our private beta, is we essentially opened it up and said, hey, look, we're still toying around with this thing. We're not really sure if this is kind of a full-fledged product yet, but we'd love to get your input. And so literally we had hundreds of people using the product, and then they would find a stock, find a data point, and then they'll report it, say, hey, this looks kind of weird. Can you look into it? We would look into it, we'd correct it. And that's essentially how we built up our initial data. And so we became the data provider rather than relying on these incumbents to provide us with that data. And in hindsight, that ended up being a great decision for us, because that data is what really made us into a valuable company. That data is what is, it's proprietary to us. We can do anything we want with it. We can, roll it out as, one product. We can roll it out as an ETF if we wanted to. We can sell that data to other people. We can be transparent with it. We could be less transparent with it. It's entirely up to us what we do with it. And so that was sort of the pivotal moment. We became more of the data provider, and then we ended up deferring all the investing related features until later. And so that's where we kind of made that round back last year. And we said, hey, we announced something called Zoya Invest. And basically we started working on our investing features, which would allow our users to not just screen companies for Sharia compliance, but then also to open up brokerage accounts and directly invest through our platform.
That's interesting. So let me ask you this, because it's interesting that you bring up the data point here. What potential companies or enterprises would be looking to acquire this data that you have or utilize it, right? I mean, I can only think of like Islamic fintech companies right now.
No, you'd be surprised. So, I mean, if you look at, so let's start there. Let's look at the Islamic fintech companies, right? So I'm sure you've heard of a few Islamic ETFs that are out there today, right? Now, if you read the name of the ETF, what does it actually say? It'll typically say, name of fintech, whatever it is, Wahid or so on and so forth. And then it'll say FTSE, FTSE, or it'll say SNP, or it'll say MSCI. So who are these guys? Who's MSCI? Who's FTSE? Who's S&P? These are conventional financial data companies and index providers. They're not Muslim, but they know that there are clients that are willing to pay for this. And so what they do is that they work with companies like us or the incumbents to say, hey, can you give us data on what stocks are compliant and not? We're going to work with our professionals to create portfolios or indices that we can then repackage and sell to these other fintechs who can then roll them out as ETFs and other investment products. And it's big business. It's a really big business. I mean, these guys are making a lot of money by doing this.
So you're are you working with, you're working directly with people who manage like and run like indexes, essentially, if I understand correctly from
what you're saying. That's one client, okay. But you know, we work with, for example, we've had banks reach out to us, right? Banks that offer kind of, you know, full set of services. They may offer brokerage accounts. And so, for example, one of our clients is KFH Capital, which is a subsidiary of Kuwait Finance House, second largest bank in Kuwait. They already have, they offer investment accounts to their customers, but the one product that allows their customers to invest in US stocks, they're getting that data from us and then filtering out the companies that are not compliant so that their customers can then invest in it. But we work with fintechs as well. They could be trading apps. It could be research firms. It could be independent financial advisors. For example, if you run a financial advisory and one of your clients happens to be Muslim and you need to be able to screen their portfolio for Sharia compliance, you can come to us, license that data from us, and then, you know, provide that as a service to your client.
Interesting. So let me ask you this, because it sounds like, you know, just the work that's going to go into building this thing that probably took you guys many months, if not many years, is work that is not usually rewarded with profit, at least not at the time that you're building it. So for an entrepreneur listening to this that wants to build something, not necessarily similar, but also like something in terms of software or tech or some type of asset to their business that is not currently producing any cash flow, how did you go about this to continue surviving throughout that period? Did you seek out external investment? Did you have savings that you were kind of, you know, pulling from? How did you manage the finances side of things?
Yeah, so going back to 2020, when we went live with this thing, we were still working our full-time jobs. And again, we weren't sure how this thing would go. And when we saw the growth initially, we were growing at one point, I think, something like 40, 50% month over month. And we scaled up revenue very quickly. So the company was self-sufficient. You know, we weren't taking any salaries at the time, just because, again, we had, you know, our paychecks coming in from our full-time jobs. So the company was running on its own. But we knew at that point that, okay, well, at this point, we can either continue to grow this thing, slowly and bootstrap it and find a way to kind of be self-sufficient as we grow it further, or we can use this opportunity to go out and raise money from investors. And so at that point, it was also a great time for startups to be raising money. And so we had already been approached by investors at that point, and we just essentially ignored them. We said, hey, we're not interested right now. But a few months later, when we decided that, hey, maybe it's worth having a conversation with them, we ended up reaching back out to them. There were a few VCs, a few angel investors, so on and so forth, but I really didn't know how to navigate it. And so what I thought was, okay, let me throw together a pitch deck just to kind of, you know, illustrate what it is that we're trying to work on. And then we'll see where this thing goes. I'm not, again, very confident that we have a, you know, kind of a investable business here, but let's just see, you know, how things look. And so I reached out to someone who I met at a conference a few years back, who I looked up to, and he also happened to live in my area as well. And so I thought, hey, this person, he has quite a bit of experience in Islamic finance. He's worked in private equity as well. So he's an investor. I just want to pick his brain. Maybe he can point me in the right direction. So I reached out to him, and we hop on a Zoom call. Again, this is during the pandemic. And I see two other people on the call as well. And I'm like, okay, this is a little strange. I wonder what's going on. And about a few minutes into the conversation, I realized that, okay, this is actually a pitch, right? This is, I'm pitching these guys, and they're going to determine whether or not they want to invest. And so I was super nervous. I wasn't ready. It was my first time pitching anything of the sort. I'm just sweating bullets. And at the end of it, they reached out and they said, hey, look, we'd like to set up another call to dive a little bit deeper. And so at that point, I'm like, okay, now I know what's going on. I'm going to be more prepared. And we did another call and another call after that. And eventually he ended up becoming my first angel investor, and it was $30,000. And so that, at that point, I'm like, okay, now I feel like I can go out and raise a lot more money. It's like if the moment that first investor, like, you know, gives you that check, you get so confident that, hey, this is possible. Yeah. And, you know, alhamdulillah, the investor is also very supportive. He's very well connected. So he started introducing us to a lot of his peers. And so some of his friends ended up becoming investors as well. So we ended up raising, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars initially just through angel investors, people in our network. These aren't even like professional investors. They're just like friends, family, deep pockets, that sort of a thing. And around that same time, we were also having conversations with VCs who were reaching out to us, but we weren't really pushing it too much. And one VC in particular ended up cold emailing us, and we said, hey, you know, whatever, let's just end up, you know, talking to them and see where it goes. And we got on the phone. They are not Muslim. These guys are based out of Chicago. They invested primarily in fintech, but they were industry agnostic. Roughly 70% of the portfolio was in fintech. And so they were just like, guys, this is really cool. We're building. We're really interested. Would you be willing to, you know, take a check from us? And I think 2.5, 3 weeks later, they wired us some money and we ended up raising about $500,000 through them. So we had about $500,000 through angel investors, another $500,000 through them, and we ended up doing a $1 million pre-seed round.
Amazing, Mashallah. I love to hear these stories, man. And I'm sure it's so inspirational for the people listening in and tuning in as well. And ultimately, it all starts with one thing. Actually, I'm going to tell you this without even revealing it. I want to hear from your own words. I want you to say this instead of me, because what I think is that it all starts with having a great product, right? But for you, I want your opinion. What do you feel like was really the selling point for the people that heard your pitch and then decided to move forward?
So this is what I tell everyone. I say, look, generally speaking, VCs or just active investors, smart investors, they don't care about the nature of your product too much, right? Mm. If you have great numbers, the numbers will speak for themselves, right? And so, yes, of course, there's things like thematic alignment and whatnot. There's a lot of dumb money out there. You don't want dumb money. You want, you know, especially early on, you want investors who can add more value than just a check, right? Mm. And so in our case, we got super lucky that the majority of our investors were Muslim. And so there was an alignment in the sense that they shared the same values and they wanted to see our product succeed. And on top of that, they were actually users of our product. So that was probably one of the easiest selling points, because they were actually using the product. They're like, hey, this is great. And I want you guys to build this further. And then when we got to the point of VCs, again, it was the numbers kind of, you know, told their own story. We're showing extreme amounts of growth. We're showing, you know, revenue coming in super early on in the stage of our company, when neither me nor my co-founder were full time yet. And they just saw that we were solving a problem for a massive market. And I think that was enough, right? Of course, you have to tell a good story, right? I mean, it's like you have to be able to demonstrate, you know, okay, the business is doing X today, but here's, you know, a somewhat achievable path to 100 million in valuation or 100 million revenue. This is what we think we need to do to get there, or here's the exit that we have in mind. So you do have to kind of think a little bit further down the road and illustrate what that may look like as an exit for investors. But the reality is that, you know, that early on, again, if you have the right investors, they're not going to push too hard, because they know that you haven't figured everything out yet, that you have something in front of you that is doing pretty well, but you need a little bit of a push. You need a little bit of guidance. You need maybe some connections to get to the next level. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, what happened with us, which, you know, we just had the numbers kind of told the story themselves, and
right.
And we had a product that people were literally begging to pay for. So I think those are all great signs.
Yeah. So the proof of concept was there, essentially, right? Like, you didn't just show up to a meeting with a business plan and say, hey, can you know, give me a couple a couple hundred thousand dollars. Like you actually went out there, you built an MVP, and you were in the trenches actually, you know, putting it out in the market and seeing how people were reacting, and you got your proof of concept.
I don't think we would have succeeded with the fundraise at all if we didn't have a product that was already in the market that had an active user base. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, again, we're building a product for a niche audience. It's a very big niche audience, but, you know, it's still a niche product. It's not proven. It's in a market where, I mean, just look at Islamic fintech over the last couple of years. I mean, we're still a very, very small industry, right? Or sub-industry, whatever, however you want to look at it. And so there weren't any success stories that you can point to and say, like, hey, look, these guys did it, right? Everyone was still kind of in transition. And so we got very lucky, alhamdulillah, that the timing was really good. Our numbers were good. The people that we met with were very supportive and connected us with the right people. You know, if we were, let's say, pre-launch, it would have been tremendously difficult. Or if, let's say, we missed it by a couple of months or a year, because as you know, the markets have not been great over the last 2 years. You know, not just when it comes to the stock market or crypto or anything like that, but also the VC market. It's been very, very, very difficult for startups to raise funding over the last year.
So let me ask you this, at this stage that you're in right now, and as well with the current financial climate, what are you focusing on at Zoia?
So, I mean, since we raised our funding round, which by the way, we have never formally announced it. So if you like Google this around, you're not going to actually find this information. And this is probably one of the first times I've disclosed it kind of openly like that. So,
Nice.
an exclusive for Homepreneur.
I love that. We'll definitely make
But,
use of that. We'll take advantage of it in the marketing this episode.
oh man, okay. That works. So we use that money to basically go in full time ourselves, right? The two founders, me and my co-founder, and then also build out our initial team. So today we have a team of 8 people full time and 2 part-time, and we're spread across 8+ countries. So we're fully distributed and work remotely. And we wanted to essentially use that money to, as I said, build the team, but then also validate our ideas. So we had an MVP that was working, but we knew that this is not in itself a big business, right? How do we start kind of thinking about the ideas to get this to the next level and the next level, right? So how do we get to 1 million users? How do we get to 10 million and 100 million and so on and so forth? And so it's really been that journey over the last, I'd say, 18 months or so. We've just been sort of experimenting with different ideas, talking to our users, building a community around what we're doing, and getting to a point where we feel like, okay, we think we've figured out what it is that we want to focus on for the next couple of years. This is kind of the gap in the market, and now we're ready to go out and do something big. And so we've intentionally stayed quiet and low key. We're more of the let us build it and then show you versus talk about it and then show you. And so we've just been heads down building. So alhamdulillah, we're in a pretty good position now in terms of the audience that we've been able to acquire in a very short period of time with essentially no marketing, as I mentioned earlier. And we're ready to kind of take things to the next level. And you know, that may mean that we may need to bring on more investors and do a bigger round and so on and so forth. But the moment you take money from investors, that's when the clock starts ticking. Right now you have money that's essentially going to run out at X amount, you know, at whatever X date. And in that time frame, you need to either make your business profitable, which, you know, again, for early stage startups, maybe that's not the focus. You want to focus more on growth, but also get your numbers or KPIs to a point where you can then go back to investors and say, look, this is what we've been able to demonstrate over the last 18, 20 months, whatever, and now we're ready to take things to the next level and we need to do a bigger raise. So that's really been our focus.
Definitely. Is there anything that you can hint at in terms of like what we can expect as consumers, customers of Zoia in the future, inshallah?
So one of the things we've been, you know, pretty open about is the kind of the next flagship feature, the next phase of our business is called Zoia Invest, which again would allow our existing users to open up brokerage accounts and directly invest through us. This is pretty compelling because if you think about it, today most of our users, they open up Zoia, they figure out what's compliant and not, and then they open up their respective trading apps and go execute trades there, right? So whether it's Robinhood, Wealthsimple, so on and so forth. And obviously there's value in bringing that experience into one app. And so you know, when we announced it, we had you know, a ton of people who are excited about it. We have a pretty large wait list, a global wait list that's you know, anticipating that feature. And we are just a matter of weeks away in terms of getting that out the door and getting some of the first few customers signing up. So it can happen as early as next week, or it can be a little bit more than that, but we're pretty excited about that. And I think that it's going to be a pretty compelling product in the sense that it's going to be a little bit different than other investing apps, because not only do you have that kind of from the ground up, you know, Muslim experience that we've built, right? Because again, that's the audience that we're going after. We're not saying, oh, this is for ethical investors or, you know, faith-based investors. We're saying, no, this is meant for Muslims, right? So we're building it from the ground up with that sort of idea in mind. And so a lot of, you know, features are specifically catered towards that. And then we also think that, you know, we have, because of our technology expertise, as well as our financial services expertise, there's a lot of interesting things we can do that would be very unique to our users. And beyond that, we're also building several different financial tools as well. Because mm-hmm. if you go back to kind of our vision of like, hey, we're thinking beyond investing, right? Like we want to be a finance app for Muslims, a one-stop shop. And so one of the things that we launched last year was actually a Zakat calculator that was specifically focused on investments. Mm-hmm. And again, this was a problem that not everyone had, but the people who had it, it was a huge problem for them. It's like, hey, I know how to calculate Zakat on everything else. It's pretty straightforward, 2.5%, this and that. When it comes to my investments, I don't know how to do it, right? And the right way to do it, most people couldn't do it because it requires a lot of calculation and research. So most people, what they would end up doing is, hey, if I have $50,000 in stocks, I'm just going to treat that as cash and take 2.5% of that. When in reality, the way you're supposed to do it is you're supposed to look at the assets and liabilities of the companies you're invested in, just as how you would for your own personal finances. And so we built a calculator that did exactly that. And we launched it at the very tail end of Ramadan last year, thinking that, you know, we missed the boat. No one's going to really use this thing. And within the first 48 hours, we had over $133 million of portfolio activity that was calculated through the tool. Wow, and so that gave us a ton of confidence. We're like, okay, this is something we need to continue building, make it better, and bring it to more people. And so we're launching the second iteration of that, you know, this Ramadan, which would be a lot more smarter with some more features, allow you to link your brokerage accounts directly in so that it's a much more faster and automated experience. And almost feels like a kind of a TurboTax for Zakat. I don't know if you're familiar with TurboTax in Canada, but yeah, so a similar experience like that, but for your investments.
Amazing, mashallah. So let me ask you this right now on the, on like from a consumer facing standpoint, how are you generating an income as a company?
So we have a freemium model. So the app is free to download. Basic features are free. One of the things that we makes us unique is that we are the only free provider of Sharia compliance data. So you can create a free account and you can get the latest status, Sharia compliance status of any company on our platform in any market for free. And it's like unlimited use. We charge a premium subscription called Zoya Pro that unlocks access to our in-depth Sharia compliance reports, our portfolio monitoring features, and some other premium stuff that we're working on, including Zoya Invest. So Zoya Invest is also going to be wrapped into our subscription because as Muslims, as a Muslim business, we can't make money through the means that most brokerage providers make money through things like lending and interest and so on and so forth. So we just have to charge a subscription. We thought that makes the most sense rather than charge even commissions because nowadays, you know, no one does commissions.
Definitely. That makes a lot of sense. And if I were to ask you one final question here, I know we're kind of going a little bit over on time, but through this experience that you've had right now over the last few years, building up this company, and truly this company, I would categorize it probably as a SaaS, right? So as a software as a service, but you do offer a lot of data, like you're also a data company. But if we're talking about the SaaS side, for someone listening in who's also building a software company on their own, what were some of the biggest lessons that you've learned throughout your journey? Some of the things that you maybe didn't know at first that would have been beneficial to know as you were building Zoya?
Well, you know, we intentionally decided to go mobile first. And so when we were building Zoya at the time, there wasn't any investing apps or really any apps in the App Store or the Play Store that were catering to Muslims when it came to finances specifically. Sorry. So obviously there's Quranic apps and things like that, but when it came to financial apps, there really wasn't anything. So we saw that as an opportunity. We said, okay, well, let's maybe launch on mobile first. And that way we can, you know, optimize for keywords and kind of be the first search result anytime someone searches up, you know, anything related to investing, halal investing or stocks and so on and so forth. And to this day, we're actually number one. So we are number one. If you search halal investing, halal stocks, we come up, you know, we're the first result in search. But, you know, as a trade-off, I think what we probably didn't anticipate was that mobile development is really hard. Mm-hmm. And you know, despite us being now, you know, a bigger team, it still takes us a lot longer to build something for mobile than it does for the web. And there's a variety of reasons there, right? I mean, just generally development on mobile has become better, but when it comes to testing and validating and putting things out, there's a lot of sort of barriers you have to go through, right? I mean, just kind of like just to even get an app update submitted, you have to go through the approval process with Google and Apple, and sometimes they reject it. And it's this multi-day, multi-step process. Whereas on the web, I can launch a feature in just a matter of minutes, right? Mm. There's no approval process that I have to go through.
Yeah.
So I think the decision at the time made sense for us to focus on mobile, but it did put us behind a little bit in terms of kind of being behind on the website of things. And even today, we still don't have our web app ready yet. We are working on it, and it will be coming very soon. But that was sort of the trade-off that we had to make at the time.
Would you make it again? Like, would you do that same decision again if you were to do it over?
No, I would probably have found a better way to do both. And which nowadays, like with, there's a lot of modern technologies that let you do both, right? I mean, you could literally build a web app and a mobile app with the same code base, right? Mm. Things like React Native and so on and so forth. There's other technologies that let you do that in a much more seamless way. We had that in mind, but we still sort of didn't focus too much on the website of things. And at this point, it's a little bit harder for, it was a little bit harder for us to do that transition because again, we're a limited, when you're a small team, you have to constantly pick and choose your priorities, right?
100%.
Again, going back to like, as soon as you raise money from investors, the clock starts, right? And now it's like, okay, well, at the very beginning, you think, oh, I'm going to work on this. I'm going to work on that. I'm going to work on this. And then all of a sudden you realize, that clock is still 100%. Clicking, right? And you need to like start focusing on things that will show results, and so you have to be very selective with what you work on. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we ended up kept deprioritizing web. And I think again, we're proud of the work that we've done on mobile. I think it's a great experience. People always say, hey, it's a beautiful app, so on and so forth. But I'm personally very excited to get on the web, and I think that's going to allow us to iterate much faster, launch and test new features much, much faster. And then we'll still bring it to the mobile, but maybe a little bit later. We don't have to, focus on that being kind of the initial place to launch it.
Yeah, thank you very much for sharing that, man. I appreciate it. So where's the best place for people to go and kind of use Zoya? So, I mean, you mentioned it yourself. It's probably by downloading the app itself. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can head over to our website. It's zoya.finance, zoya.finance. Mm-hmm. You can follow us on Twitter at Zoya Finance, Instagram at zoya.finance. We've been producing a lot of educational content over the last couple of months because we feel like it's really necessary for the market that we're going after. When it comes to financial literacy, it's already lacking when it comes to the general public. And then when you kind of layer on Islamic finance on top of that, I think it becomes even more intimidating. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to come up with a lot of educational content that is actually useful, it's unique, that is actionable. And so definitely check out our blog, blog.zoya.finance. I think there's a lot of unique content there. We also recently launched a free 12-part email course, which you can access at learn.zoya.finance. So this is for people who, for example, you have no idea where to start, whether it comes to investing, whether it comes to halal investing, anything of that sort. Go to this website, sign up. Every single day for 12 days, we'll send you a very short bite-sized lesson to help you learn the fundamentals. And hopefully by the end of the 12 days, you'll feel a lot more confident in your investing journey. So those are some of the places you can find us. For me personally, you can reach me on Twitter. Twitter is at Saad Malik, or on LinkedIn. Those are typically the two places that I'm most active.
Thank you so much, Saad, for joining me today. I'm going to make sure to include those links in the show notes. I really appreciate your time and I really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you for that.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Abby.
My pleasure. Take care. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum.